Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Richard Zether, the co-curator of Iraq's Ancient Past, Rediscovering Ur's Royal Cemetery, a new exhibition opening this weekend at the Penn Museum. David Patrick Stearns profiles the controversial Italian conductor Daniel Gatti. He leads the Philadelphia Orchestra in a series of concerts this week. Susan Lewis explores the Philadelphia Museum of Art's new retrospective on the 20th century artist Arshile Gorky. His work was a bridge between surrealism and abstract expressionism. And we speak with Losang Samtan. The renowned Tibetan-born Buddhist scholar and former monk begins a month-long public sculpting of a Kala Chakra sand mandala at the Gershman Y in Philadelphia on Monday. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Iraq's Ancient Past, Rediscovering Ur's Royal Cemetery, a new exhibition at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology, the Penn Museum, brings together artifacts from an ancient burial site in what is today southeastern Iraq. In 1922, the year of Howard Carter's sensational discovery of Tutankhamun's tomb in Egypt, the University of Pennsylvania Museum and the British Museum embarked upon a joint expedition to the ancient site of Ur, led by British archaeologist Sir Leonard Woolley. This expedition also made headlines by uncovering an extraordinary 4,500-year-old royal cemetery with more than 2,000 burials, detailing a remarkable ancient Mesopotamian civilization. The new long-term exhibition, which opens tomorrow, details that expedition through field notes, photographs, archival documents, and more than 200 ancient artifacts uncovered by Woolley and his team. Iraq's Ancient Past also speaks to pressing contemporary issues concerning the preservation of Iraq's cultural heritage today. My first topic when I spoke with the show's co-curator, Richard Zether. How important was it, in view of what happened in Iraq after the U.S. invasion, to the antiquities there that there were so many holdings overseas?
Well, I think that it was fortuitous, given what happened to the Iraq Museum and other cultural institutions in Baghdad, that collections from excavations earlier than 1967 were dispersed around the world, though this was, you know, a real prize for museums and institutions involved at the time. As I say, though, it was fortuitous. Technically, all this material should be in the holdings of the government of Iraq.
How likely is it that these antiquities will be returned anytime soon?
Everything that we have here in Penn Museum was exported legally under the antiquities laws in force at the time. So I think that the Iraqi government, given the laws in place, probably has no claim on most of these or no legal claim on the antiquities that we hold. On the other hand, there is a kind of moral imperative of sharing the treasures with the Iraqi people.
What can we learn from this latest exhibition here at the Penn Museum?
Well, I think what we've tried to do in Iraq's Ancient Past is really to showcase or highlight the artifacts from the Royal Cemetery of Ur, but more importantly, to contextualize them in terms of the excavations, that is, how the excavations came about as Iraq was being born, the process of digging and interpreting the finds, and then also to contextualize them as living, breathing museum collections. That is, they are not just dusty artifacts in some curio cabinet, but these are artifacts that still have an enormous amount to tell us. And we have, as researchers, as archaeologists, have to ask the right questions, employ the right methodologies, the right technologies, and we can make these artifacts yield new information about ancient Mesopotamia.
And what have you learned so far?
Well, one of the most striking examples of artifacts in museums as being capable of speaking came from two well-preserved heads of royal attendants from different tombs in the royal cemetery. These were well-preserved in the ground. Woolley consolidated them and lifted them with the soil matrix, basically for exhibit. Woolley didn't really keep many of the skeletal remains, the bones from the attendants in the royal cemetery. They were poorly preserved, and he didn't make the effort to get them out of the ground. So these heads became one possible way for us to see if we could determine the probable cause of death of the royal attendants. You may know that Woolley believed that the attendants in the royal tombs went willingly to their deaths with their kings and queens, drinking some poison, and then lying down, composing themselves for service in the netherworld. But we put these two heads through CT scans at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania and got lucky, really, that we were able to see in the CAT scans a probable cause of death. And it really had to do with a blow to the back of the head and probably not with poisoning, though we can't conclusively rule that out.
And probably not willingly in that case.
And probably not willingly, not if they put a pick through the back of your skull.
To what extent did Iraq, as we know it of its modern borders, to what extent did it live in a vacuum culturally, artistically, or have we been able to define from what you have here anything about that?
Well, the land that is today Iraq was always a center, a cradle of civilization. This is where modern societies were born, really, where we have political leadership in the form of kings, where we have complex economy, global trading networks. That land is also a kind of land bridge between the Mediterranean and the Persian Gulf to the south. So it never really was a vacuum at all. And in fact, the royal tombs of Ur, if they show us nothing else, show us the global economy in which the early Mesopotamians, the Sumerians, were integrated, because all of the materials in the royal tombs had to be imported from outside, the metallic ores, the exotic stones, all of these sorts of things, because Iraq is a resource-poor area. Yes, it has oil, but that wasn't very much useful in the past. Its greatest resource, I always tell students, is dirt. It's good agricultural land. It has and can support not just growing crops, but the animals that feed on them. So all of these exotic materials had to be brought in from outside, and they really outline for us, and we've tried to show that in this exhibit, the trading networks that Iraq was part of.
Richard Zettler, Associate Curator in Charge of the Near East Section at the Penn Museum and co-curator of Iraq's Ancient Past, Rediscovering Ur's Royal Cemetery, which opens at the Penn Museum tomorrow.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Philadelphia Orchestra has another music director contender, Daniel Gatti, the Italian conductor of the French National Orchestra and the Zurich Opera. He guest conducted here and a number of other places in the 1990s. Didn't make much of an impression, but at age 47, a generation older than some of the other contenders, has emerged as a changed man during this week's program of Mendelssohn and Brahms that was cheered by audiences and respected by the orchestra's musicians. The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns caught up with Gatti backstage at the Metropolitan Opera last week, where he's also conducting Aida, and sometimes being booed by New Yorkers, but not being cheered by Philadelphians.
Daniel Gatti knows that the older he gets, the more different he becomes. That's true for most artists, but his first round of high-profile American debuts in the 1990s gave no hint of what was to emerge, a conductor with a personal, singular relationship with music that other conductors view from a respectful distance. Backstage at the Met, his attitude was, "Why repeat what others have already done supremely well?"
And if I have to repeat it, change profession. I don't want to be eccentric. I just study the score, I just have an opinion, and I brief the music with the score, and I try to be, to deserve the composer. Then what will come out is the music through my soul. A lot of people are going to concert with the idea that the piece has to sound like this, but it's not always true.
While you can predict a strong viewpoint from Gatti, you can't predict what it will be. His Brahms Symphony No. 1 on Thursday at the Kimmel Center showed the Philadelphia Orchestra sound at its most saturated, though Mendelssohn's Italian Symphony, well, a bit slower than usual, was almost Mozartian in its transparency, not unlike this performance Gatti conducted with the Vienna Philharmonic 4 months ago. A seems that Gatti crossed over from Italy into the imaginary world that Mendelssohn created in his Midsummer Night's Dream music. How did Gatti get there? For starters, he isn't about to thrill audiences with tempo. He takes Mendelssohn off the Autobahn.
We need to listen to all the modulations. We need to listen to the breathing of that sort of fresh air in Italy, but not that everybody is going at 160 miles per hour, no? Just to have wider tempi, I think that was, for me, very satisfying.
Gatti's repertoire defies national typecasting. He's had more success with Wagner than with Verdi, though his early appointments were at the Santa Cecilia Orchestra in Rome and the Teatro Comunale in Bologna. What made his career was his somewhat recently concluded 13-year association with London's Royal Philharmonic, now headed by Charles Dutoit. There, Gatti made a series of recordings that showed how much he'd changed. Since then, he's been giving authoritative performances in unexpected musical places, such as Debussy's seldom-heard Martyrdom of St. Sebastian, or André Previn's brand-new Harp Concerto. If there's a single factor in the originality of Gatti's viewpoints, it's his little-known life as a composer. In a way, it doesn't matter how good he is at composing. The mere fact that he does it gives him an insight into the music's creative process that, in theory, allows him to meet Mendelssohn and Brahms at eye level. And Gatti's own music does have its moments, such as this divertimento for oboe and orchestra.
This is my secret love, because actually I began to write music at 11 and I fall in love for conducting at 13. For a while I did both, but then the love of conducting was much, much stronger. And sometime I return with my pencil to write something, and just for fun. But I'm very scared to present my music. But I studied for 10 years composition, I degree in that, so my conscience is okay.
Some of Gatti's least smooth sailing, however, has been in the past year, and an unlikely repertoire. He has a long-standing relationship with Verdi, including what was considered a memorable performance of the Requiem in London, but last December, when Gatti returned to his hometown of Milan and conducted the opening night performance of Don Carlo at La Scala, he was booed, not at the end, but at some of his entrances in the opera's individual acts. Those who saw the live simulcast at the Bryn Mawr Film Institute observed Gatti responding with a smile.
I knew that it was a group that came for the premiere to disturb the premiere. And some people are following me, because it's happened also in Munich.
It happened here, yeah?
It's happened here, I think.
What's that about?
I don't know. Maybe I'm... Well, people could have their taste. They maybe hate me, fine, okay. No problem.
He was also booed on opening night of Aida at the Met. The problem is hard to determine. Some lauded Gatti for showing them an Aida they'd never heard. Others complained about slowish tempi. Some say he's lazy. Strange, considering that today, Gatti is conducting an Aida matinee in New York and an evening concert in Philadelphia. Some complained he got in the way of the singers, which couldn't have been so serious, since principal baritone Carlo Guelfi was making dinner plans with Gatti during my backstage visit. Well, that's opera, where opinions are extreme and polarized. What Gatti doesn't like is when booing interferes with the performance.
I think this is absolutely unfair. At the end of the opera is the moment to demonstrate if you agree or if you liked or you dislike, and then you can do it. Why during the show? Let's do to the end if you want, and not to be judged number by number like a scholarship, you know?
Might there be some sort of karmic revenge at work here? Near the end of a long, hard 2004 tour of the U.S. with the Royal Philharmonic, the obviously frazzled Gatti concluded a concert in Florida by lecturing the audience about the difficult circumstances, both acoustical and otherwise, as if the ticket buyers were responsible. it would seem that Gatti has a dark side, but doesn't everybody? Maybe it's an Italian thing. God knows Riccardo Muti did more than his share of audience lecturing during his years in Philadelphia. But Gatti's Florida incident was 5 years ago. His life is different, his marriage dissolved, he now has a fiancée in France, and his professional commitments aren't as heavy as they look. His Zurich opera appointment, for example, averages only 2 productions a year. And he takes his booing with a smile.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. Daniil Gatti conducts the Philadelphia Orchestra in the final concert of a program featuring works by Rossini, Mendelssohn, and Brahms at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall this evening at 8. A new exhibition at the Philadelphia Museum of Art takes a fresh look at 20th century abstract expressionist painter Arshile Gorky. The first major retrospective since 1981, this show explores Gorky's creative process in context with his life story, hidden details of which have been revealed in recent biographies. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Arshile Gorky, a retrospective.
A tall, dark-haired man with a trim mustache wearing a T-shirt under a tan work coat looks out from the canvas. Behind him, through a window, a landscape is suggested by broad brushstrokes of greens, blues, and browns, the details of which, like those of his mitten-shaped hands, are left to the imagination. His pensive gaze suggests he knows something we don't. Exhibition curator Michael Taylor found this 1937 self-portrait evocative of the themes explored throughout the retrospective.
The use of color, the way in which the paintbrush has been used, the brushstrokes, and just the fact that he is this heroic figure. He's an artist who struggled and overcame many difficulties.
Arshile Gorky began life as Vostanik Adoyan in rural Armenia. He came to the U.S. as a teenager in 1920, having been driven from his home by Turkish troops and seen his mother die of starvation, a history he decided to keep secret as he pursued a career as a painter, first in Boston, then in New York. And he took a new name.
I think he felt that his own name was not artistic enough, so he invented a new life for himself as the cousin of the Russian writer Maxim Gorky.
While he kept the memory of his mother alive in drawings and paintings, he also embarked on a search for identity in his life and work, teaching himself by painting portraits, still lifes, and landscapes, experimenting with cubism and surrealism, emulating, with striking success, the art of Cézanne, Picasso, Matisse, and other modern European artists.
And he didn't just paint in their styles. He really adopted their mannerisms, their way of thinking. Cézanne had a beard, so he grew a beard. And all of this was a kind of self-creation. It's only in the 1940s that Gorky becomes Gorky. He finds his own way of working.
While Gorky's work imitating the European masters was challenged by some of his contemporaries as derivative, Philadelphia Museum of Art director Timothy Rubb sees it instead as an important foundation for what was to come. He says Gorky absorbed their work and then turned it to his own purposes.
That kind of dialogue or interaction between European and American art is very important for what happens in the 40s and the 50s. And Gorky was a critical player in that regard.
In 1941, Gorky married Agnes Magruder, affectionately known as Magooch, whose parents had a farm in Virginia. Gorky biographer Hayden Herrera, who, as a child, became part of the artist's family when her father married Gorky's widow, says this countryside recalled Gorky's own childhood in rural Armenia.
I think his marriage and having children and having access to the country completely brought him out and freed his creative process.
Gorky would take his drawing board out and sit in the fields.
He looked at the grass and he saw creatures and insects that would be transformed into very strange shapes.
What came out of it was a kind of organic abstraction. He's translating the natural world into a new visual syntax. And no one had made art like this.
These drawings led to paintings in which Gorky created further abstractions. Herrera, who lived with this art after Gorky died, says as children, she and his daughters were fascinated by these shapes.
We would look at these paintings and always try and find images in them, which is what you're not supposed to do, but we couldn't help it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, Gorky said, I never put a face on an image. He didn't want you to find rabbits and people and horses, although you can find them very easily.
Gorky moved the art form forward, says Michael Taylor, in the way he portrayed emotions through paint. As just one example, Taylor points to the 1944 work called Scent of Apricots on the Fields. It shimmers with reds, oranges, yellows, and greens.
I almost get the sense that this is a tabletop with fruits and onions, but he moves it into a whole nother realm. And it's through the use of color, that freedom of color, and also the way in which the paint is applied. It's stained, it's kind of pooling here. This is going to open up complete new possibilities for painting.
While the abstractions of the paintings may appear free-flowing, Gorky was precise in his process. A number of his drawings are marked by grids he created on top so as to accurately translate his compositions to canvas. He called his studio the Creation Chamber, and curator Michael Taylor uses this idea as a way to consider his art. Works, presented chronologically, show how he explored themes. Drawings are shown with the paintings to which they led, often created in multiple versions with various color combinations suggesting different moods.
He will do an original drawing, and then he'll make a finished drawing, he'll begin painting, and he might encounter problems or issues in the painting itself that will lead to another drawing. It was a process of abstraction where he's removing more and more.
Gorky's career progressed, although Herrera says he never made a lot of money. He took students, and the influential New York City art dealer Julian Levy showed his work in 1945. But the colorful, upbeat works of the early and mid-40s gave way to more somber works as a series of calamities darkened Gorky's life.
First, his studio burnt down. Then he was operated for rectal cancer and had a colostomy operation. And then the drawings changed.
After the fire in 1946, he creates a series of paintings called Charred Beloveds, with sooty images and textures, each painting more drained of color. After his operation to remove the cancer in 1947, he paints a work called Agony, its surface afire with reds and blacks. The end of his life, says Herrera, was miserable. He broke his neck in a car accident.
And his painting arm was paralyzed, and he thought he'd never paint again. And Magooch left him because he'd become kind of crazy and a little bit violent. And so she took the children to her mother to get them out of this somewhat dangerous situation. And then he killed himself.
At the time of Gorky's death, Michael Taylor says American abstract painting was just becoming internationally lauded.
And had Gorky lived, there's no question he would have been the leader of that moment. He would have been the artist that everyone would have looked to. He had opened the door to these artists.
Philadelphia Museum of Art director Timothy Rubb says Gorky's work propelled a new generation.
Clearly people like Mark Rothko, Willem de Kooning, Jackson Pollock, the great figures of the late 40s and 1950s, knew and were inspired by Gorky's work, and it served as a kind of platform for them to move on in their own work.
Rubb says the artist is acknowledged by many to be a painter's painter.
That is to say, artists learn a lot from looking at his work. He was a very, very gifted draftsman. He was enormously imaginative, formally speaking, in terms of the images he created. And he had a restless kind of desire to always experiment and push the boundaries of the medium forward.
This show demonstrates how Vostanek Adoyan, turned Arshil Gorky, did just that, starting out as a masterful chameleon and growing into an artistic leader of daring proportions. His work always intertwined with and informed by his life, especially the childhood he had once intended to leave behind.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Arshil Gorky, a retrospective, runs through January 10th at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. On Monday, Losang Samten, a Tibetan Buddhist scholar and master of the meditative art of sand painting, begins a four-week-long construction of a Kalachakra sand mandala, the most colorful and intricate of all Tibetan sand mandalas, at the Gershman Y in Philadelphia. The work is described as a gift to Philadelphia, where Samten has made his home for the past 20 years. After the mandala is completed, it will be ceremonially dismantled and the sand gathered and poured into the Schuylkill River. I spoke with Losang Samten earlier this week.
Mandala, it represents one individual, how to achieve enlightenment. The foundation is the white sand. I color about 20 different colors. Each color is shaped, is designed, have a meaning of the whole meditation of yoga. But even the color and the design is just hard to put in the word. It's just such a detail, but fascinating. The mandala is how to overcome suffering.
It's a meditation for the artist. Is it also a meditation for the viewer of the...
Everybody. Everybody. We're saying that the reason we're doing this truly to wish to bring more peace. We do this practice or tradition, create this design with a prayer, with a meditation for the artist and the people, and just looking at it, we're saying it really has a tremendous power, energy to overcome suffering.
Does it ever hurt that you spend a month creating something of beauty, knowing all the time that at the end of it you are required by tradition to dismantle it?
Not at all. Not at all. That is a common question people ask me everywhere. So what happened to dismantle? Are you best sad? But sometimes I put an example. This is like a cake for the Mother Earth. So we create a wonderful design, a cake, and offer to the universe.
How does the month you spend creating one of these mandalas, how does it change you as a person, or does it change you?
Well, it changed every day. And it changed me every time I do the mandala, my motivation and the focus. I won't say it changed rapidly, but I think there's the changes. 1988, when I'm doing the mandala, this mandala, in New York, American Museum of Natural History, my mind is really a monkey mind. But today, now, for example, any mandala I do, I just want to finish not too long ago. So really my mind, I'm not saying I'm enlightened, I'm not saying I overcome suffering, but my focus, I can concentrate a lot better than 20 years ago. So that I seeing the change.
Final question, what are the craft skills that one needs? We talk about this being a meditation and being a mental and an emotional and a theological exercise, but clearly there are artistic skills that one needs to be able to create something like
Very
this.
True.
So is it painting? Is it sculpting? What are the skills?
It's a painting. In this case, it's a painting. My teacher says about it doesn't matter how the flower look, but it's a matter to your motivation. The meaning will be important rather than how to create that flower of beauty. So sometimes, even though one mandala drawing a lotus flower, which we're going to see in the middle of this mandala, there's a lotus flower. But lotus flower, sometimes, you know, depend on the artist's skill. Right away we can notice that is a lotus. Sometimes we need to say, this is a lotus. So that's only the differences. But it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter, but the meaning is so profound.
And does your lotus look like a lotus?
Oh, I hope so. I'm doing this over 30 years. And coming good, really.
The venerable Tibetan Buddhist scholar and former monk, Losang Samten. He begins a month-long construction of a Kalachakra San Mandala at the Gershwin Y in Philadelphia on Monday. Many activities will surround his work, a dance workshop and collaboration between Andrea Clearfield, Manfred Fischbeck, members of the Group Motion Dance Company and students of the University of the Arts, a screening of a documentary film on the making of the movie Kundam, and Losang himself will give a talk on the significance of the Kalachakra Mandala and lead a special Kalachakra meditation. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ribchester, and performed by Symphony in C under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.